Meeting will come to order. We're just waiting for Representative Davidson of the group.
Oh, sure.
Members, just a couple of things. One, in your packets are our new handouts. If you happen to file these, if you're that compulsive that you've saved the other ones, the handouts, when they appeared before us, had incorrect information. They have corrected it, and these have the corrected numbers. So that was for your information as a correction from that meeting. And then you may have noticed Holly Iverson, who was our GOP researcher, has a new job, and we didn't even realize that before she had her last day here, so we didn't say an official goodbye to her. But we're joined this morning by Abigail Johnson, who is an addition to our committee. Welcome, and we hope it's an enjoyable assignment for you. Members, we have two commissioners with us today. We're doing the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and then DHS, particularly the St. Peter Security Hospital. And because we have both commissioners and they have a cabinet meeting at 9, we're going to take things a little bit out of order. We'll hear first from Commissioner Tingerthal and then from Commissioner Jessen, and then they can be on their way to their cabinet meeting, and then we'll continue with our agenda as is. And we do have some people testifying on the housing portion of the bonding request. So welcome to the committee, Commissioner Tingerthal, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Houseman. My name is Mary Tingerthal. I'm commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and we're really delighted to be here and happy to be part of the discussion as you consider what might be included in a bonding bill this year. Thank you. We do have a handout PowerPoint presentation. We thought we'd walk through it just in paper. For those of you who may not be familiar with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, we have a mission of financing affordable housing for low and moderate income households while fostering strong communities. What that last phrase means is that we work very closely in cooperation with communities across the state of Minnesota to make sure we're just not a bank, but that the activities that we finance are fitting well into overall redevelopment strategies. Moving on to the second page of the handout, slide number 3. This morning we'll talk just briefly about Minnesota housing and a little bit about our numbers. Talk about housing infrastructure bonds, which would be the type of bonds to be included in any bonding bill, general obligation bonds for public housing, and then talk a little bit about the need and demand for these resources for housing. Moving on to slide number 4. We do have a strategic plan for the agency, and it has 5 strategic priorities where we focus the bulk of our resources. The first and probably the longest running program for the agency is promoting and supporting successful home ownership. We run a very large program where we purchase loans from local banks and lending institutions. We'll do about $350 million worth of mortgage financing for low-income families this year. Second is to preserve federally subsidized rental housing, and that's something that is one of our key categories for the use of housing infrastructure bonds. There are about 40,000 units of rental housing throughout the state of Minnesota that come with federal rental subsidies attached to them, and they're a very precious resource because if those buildings were ever to move out of the program, those rental subsidies would be lost forever to the state. The third category is meeting critical needs in rental housing markets. This can take many different forms depending on the different markets. One of the initiatives that the governor has presented this year would support the development of workforce housing in Minnesota communities where there are employers who are experiencing the opportunity to grow their businesses but have a shortage of housing across the spectrum. Fourth, one of our largest programs in terms of using state appropriated dollars is to prevent and end homelessness. And over the last 8 years, as we've worked on a statewide business plan to end homelessness, we have worked with the Department of Human Services and other state agencies to provide over 4,000 units of permanent supportive housing. Which means that those 4,000 households no longer need to use emergency shelters. And finally, we've had a steady program of preventing foreclosures and supporting community recovery. And I'm very happy to say that our activity there is able to be somewhat diminished because we do appear to be coming out of the foreclosure crisis. Both the homeless program and foreclosure remediation are also subjects of housing infrastructure bonds. Moving on to page slide number 5, just to give you an idea of scale for the agency in a given year. Last year, 2012, we served over 63,000 households with about $638 million worth of resources. Of that $638 million, only 9% of those dollars come from state appropriations. The rest come from the sale of bonds, various federal resources, etc. To give you an idea of how those funds are targeted to serve those most in need, 78% of all the renters that were served had an annual income of under $20,000. 54% of the home buyers that we assisted had an annual income of under $45,000. We assisted more than 2,300 people to buy their first homes, of which about 23% were households of color. And just in case you're interested, that compares to the regular market where about 15 to 16% of the households are households of color. Our agency overview, we're a little different from other state agencies in a number of respects. The statute that created the agency and contains most of our enabling legislation is 462A. It establishes management and control of the agency vested in the members of our board of directors. There are 7 directors, 6 of whom are appointed by the governor in staggered terms, and the 7th member is the state auditor. The operating budget of the agency is not funded by state appropriations. We use earnings largely off of our mortgage lending programs to pay all of the operating costs of the agency. That's about $25.5 million, and it's only about 3.2% when calculated based on the assistance we provided. An important note is that nearly all of the assistance that goes to either developers, renters, homeowners is provided through a network of private delivery partners. We don't do anything directly. We don't own any housing. We don't make any single-family mortgages. We use the private sector, both for-profit entities, developers and banks, and nonprofit entities, developers and social service agencies that are located in communities throughout the state to deliver the programs. So we wouldn't have the kind of results we have for families without that very rich network of private partners. Moving on to slide number 7, the chair of this committee asked that we review how the funds were utilized last year from an appropriation, I should say an allocation of bonding authority that was included in last year's bonding bill. It was a total of $35.5 million in bonding, $30 million of which were for a category called housing infrastructure bonds, and $5.5 million of which was general obligation bonds that were used for public housing. Under the $30 million in housing infrastructure bonds, which I'll talk about what those are in just a second, there were 4 possible activities that we could fund. It addresses the affordable housing infrastructure needs through preservation of existing federally subsidized housing, as I mentioned earlier, stabilizing communities for impact of the foreclosure crisis, and constructing the acquisition or rehabilitation of supportive housing. That's housing for those who have formerly been homeless. Moving on to slide number 8. Housing infrastructure bonds are a little bit out of the ordinary, but we found that they are a very effective tool for providing deferred loan financing for transactions. Many of the tools that we use for financing rental housing are federal tools. We use predominantly the low-income housing tax credit, which allows private corporations to invest in affordable housing in return for 10 years' worth of tax credits on their corporate income taxes. Usually projects that are developed with the low-income housing tax credit are able to support a mortgage, and oftentimes there's just a small gap between the amount of equity raised from the tax credits, the debt that the project is able to support, and the total development cost of the property. And that's where the state has utilized for many years various types of funding to provide that gap financing. The bonds are issued by Minnesota Housing, and the debt service for the bonds are made through a standing appropriation. One of the questions that were asked is, why do you need this strange category of bonds? And the point is that in the United States, we have chosen a system of providing affordable housing through a vast network of private owners. So most of the affordable housing in this country is owned, managed, and operated by private sector owners using various public tools, but decisions being made by private sector owners and investors. The state constitution in Minnesota prohibits us from using general obligation bond proceeds to benefit private owners. And so solution that we have successfully proposed is the use of appropriation bonds, and so that is why you see this odd category of bonds that are not GO bonds but really operate very much like GO bonds. Another question that we're frequently asked is, what's the cost of appropriation bonds compared to GO bonds? And what we found as we've issued these bonds in the past is that they are not materially different. About this, maybe a little bit more expensive, but only at a very slight level. What we get in return for providing these resources is an agreement by these private owners to maintain housing affordability for at least the term of the bonds, which is 20 years. To be honest with you, most frequently the affordability period is much longer than that, a minimum of 30 years, but that is the requirement under the statute. We will then go on to page 9. We have given you just a summary of how we utilize the $30 million worth of housing infrastructure bonds last year. The applications were solicited through a competitive application process. This is a process that we go through every year and utilize a variety of resources, those federal housing tax credits, federal home dollars, state appropriations, agency mortgage dollars, and for example, last year we awarded a total of $143 million to projects throughout the state, and I'll go over a map in just a second. We included the housing infrastructure bonds in that same competitive process, and what that gives us an opportunity to do is to do a best match between the resources that are available and the projects that are funded so that we get the most leverage out of state dollars that we can. So we don't often talk about the projects that were specifically funded through housing infrastructure bonds. We tend to talk about them in the context of the overall funds that were awarded. But for purposes of this morning, there were in fact 9 multifamily projects that were funded for a total of $26.3 million, 577 units. Five community land trusts received $1.77 million. An interesting factor about tax-exempt bonds is that they cannot generally be used for single-family housing that's owned by private individuals, but because of the legal structure of community land trusts, they can be used by the land trust to buy the property underneath the house, and because the land trust holds that property over the long term. So that's the one use of housing infrastructure bonds that can be used for single family housing, and we did use it to a great extent. Those dollars, the $30 million, will leverage more than $73 million in other financing coming from a variety of resources. And you might ask, where are the missing dollars that make up to 30? There are certain expenses that will be incurred in the issuance of the bonds, and that's that small amount that is not shown as being awarded.
Representative Detmer has a question.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I know that there's some communities that use TIF to promote or to bring in low-income housing. How does that work into what we're talking about today, tax increment financing?
Representative Dittmer and Madam Chair, oftentimes local communities will work with private developers to identify a site where the developer and the community think it would be good to develop affordable housing. And some communities do choose to establish those sites as tax increment sites. And we can count the benefit of that tax increment as part of the match that comes to the table. In awarding these funds, we're often looking to pick those projects that bring the most leverage to the table, as well as many other criteria, and that can be counted as a match. Not all communities choose to do that, but many of them do.
Madam Chair, could you maybe explain to the rest of the committee members what TIF is? If you could. I know it's a complicated subject. But
I'll try to be brief. Tax increment financing essentially forgives a portion of the property taxes on a piece of property that is typically, it's a piece of property that's sitting vacant, so it's not currently generating property taxes. So the idea is that by generating a development on that piece of property and therefore generating a future stream of property taxes, that a good trade-off is to forgive the property taxes or portion of them for the initial years of a development, and essentially you're able to take the present value of that property tax income and sell it to investors to get the upfront value as an equity investment in the property. Then after it's out of the TIF period, the community realizes that property tax increase that was generated by the development of the project.
Madam, just a quick follow-up. Now, during that time frame, is the tax then shifted over to other properties then that's collected, that would normally be collected?
Commissioner?
Representative, tax increment financing is not my expertise, and certainly very controversial in many communities, and there are public hearing requirements so that communities can make a decision about whether the trade-off that's implied in TIF is a good one for the community.
Please continue.
Thank you. Moving on to slide 10, and the committee members will see that on page 6 of the handout, there's actually a large copy of the map, which is quite a bit easier to read. This is a little bit complicated because of the multiple funding sources that I mentioned. The orange triangles represent the projects that were funded last year that did not use housing infrastructure bonds, so those came from a variety of other sources. And the ones that have the green pentagons, I guess those are foreclosure remediation projects. The light blue squares are preservation projects, and the purple circles are supportive housing projects. So all told, there were 9 projects that were specifically selected for funding out of the housing infrastructure bonds, but that's in the context of 24 additional projects that did not use the housing infrastructure bond proceeds. The reason we think it's important to show it this way is that sometimes there are projects that can make better use of the bond proceeds for various legal reasons, and we wanted to be sure to show you that there is good distribution of the resources around the state, and if you look just at the infrastructure bonds, you might not see that full picture.
Representative Clark, we're on a little bit of a time crunch. We might save questions.
It's not a question.
We need to get.
I just was going to let the commissioner know that our map is in black and white, so we don't have the benefit of those colors.
So that
maybe maps in color might be delivered to the committee later. That's all.
Yeah, we will definitely do that. Sorry about that. Yeah.
We'll get those and get them to the committee.
Yeah. Thank you. Moving on to slide number 11. We pulled out a couple of specific examples to give you a tangible idea of how these bond proceeds will be utilized. The first example is a project in St. Cloud, Minnesota. It'll be sponsored by Common Bond Housing, and it will produce 35 units of housing for veterans that have been formerly homeless. This project is actually on the grounds of the VA hospital in St. Cloud. It is literally walking distance to all of the services of the St. Cloud Medical Center. We've met with the staff at the medical center, and I have to say they are so thrilled that this project is going forward. It's a little tricky in terms of all of the financing and federal government liaisons that have to come to fruition to make it happen, but we're well on our way. The incomes will be between 30% and 50% of area median income, and this received $3.9 million in housing infrastructure bond proceeds and $2.3 million in other financing. That may be a little bit understated because the benefit of locating on the VA hospital grounds is that the VA is providing a long-term lease on the property at $0. So quite an interesting project. Also, another example on slide number 12 is the Rochester Square Apartments. This is a rehabilitation of a project that was originally built with federal Section 8 rental subsidies back in the early 80s. Many of these projects are located throughout the state in many of your districts, and they tend to have been very well-built buildings, but because they're between 35 and 40 years old, they oftentimes need some capital investments in their infrastructure, might be elevators, might be windows, might be the building skin, and we feel that with some investments in these properties that they will be good for another 40 years. This project received an allocation of $4 million in housing infrastructure bond proceeds and will have $6.2 million in other financing. It's 104 units of housing. It's located right in downtown Rochester, and over 90% of the units have project-based Section 8. That means rental assistance that's attached to the project itself. And all of the households there are at or below 50% of median income. This building is primarily occupied by senior and disabled households. The final example is in the foreclosure remediation category, and that is to a group called Two Rivers Community Land Trust. Sometimes people are surprised to learn that there are land trusts working in suburban areas around the Twin Cities. We have a very active network of land trusts in Minnesota that do very good work. They will receive $380,000 in housing infrastructure bond proceeds to buy land, and they will acquire and rehabilitate 8 homes. Moving on to slide number 14, the second piece of the bonding allocation was $5.5 million in GO bonds. This is being used for the renovation of publicly owned housing. So these are public housing authorities that are located throughout the state. And it was really designed to address some very basic investment needs, health and safety issues, replacing major systems, and energy conservation measures. We're able to stabilize almost 1,000 units of housing through these dollars, and it will leverage $3 million in local federal resources. These were also selected through a competitive application process, although a separate one from the private developments. An example of a project that was done is Glenwood Manor in Glenwood, Minnesota, which is owned by the Housing Authority. They'll receive $450,000 of GO bonds for window replacements and upgrades of their boilers and HVAC system, and that's a 30-unit project in Glenwood. Finally, ending with a statement of demand for these kinds of properties. A third of Minnesota households pay more than 30% of their income for housing. This is something we've reviewed with the Housing Committee at some length. 50% of those who are renters in Minnesota spend more than 30% of their income for housing costs. Last year, when we put these funds out in the market, there were 87 applications for multifamily developments, of which we were able to fund 39. We, as I mentioned earlier, we ran this as a competition for all of our resources. We typically receive 3 to 4 times as many applications for deferred financing, meaning a dollar amount 3 to 4 times as much as we have available. And in the GO bond category, we received 20 applications and funded 14. And I will note that not all of those 14 were funded in full. Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation.
And we'll have the Commissioner Tanya Orr is here, and so we'll go back to her with questions in a bit. But because of the time and because we have another commissioner here, we're going to now just jump ahead to the Department of Human Services. This is a very significant request, and it seemed appropriate to give her an opportunity. By the way, members, we're joined by our newly elected Representative Clark Johnson, who represents this area, and you're certainly welcome to join us at the table should you have questions later. That is an area. He's not a member of our committee, but newly elected and representing this project. So, welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. And thank you, Madam Chair, for accommodating my schedule. And I'm just delighted to be here today to talk to you about the planning work we're engaged in to renovate and improve Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter. You know, I do need to emphasize at this point this is not a governor's recommendation, but last year the governor did recommend capital funding to support renovation of the security hospital. And while that request wasn't funded by the legislature, we were provided funding for pre-design and work and design work, and I really want to thank this committee for their support and attention to this important issue. So you'll get a full presentation from Chuck Johnson, who will go through our PowerPoints, and I'm sorry if our slides aren't in color either. He'll provide you the details, but I just really did want to provide you with just my thoughts on why I thought this was so important. You know, the security hospital, as many of you all know, provides treatment to people who are committed to the department, to me as commissioner, as mentally ill and dangerous. And there really is not more important work that we do at the department than care and the treatment for these people. Security hospitals on our campus in St. Peter, and so is kind of the stage phases 3 and 4 of our sex offender treatment program, and that's part of the challenges that we see. But I also just want to be up front and say we have many challenges at Security Hospital. Last year, as commissioner, I actually put a condition on the license, which is the best, most serious thing I can do as commissioner other than shut down a program, on the condition on the license of Security Hospital. And I did that after our licensing department found a pattern across many years of inappropriate use of seclusion and restraints. And we also have a problem in Security Hospital that we have far too many staff injuries. And these are really important matters. We are working very hard on them. Last year, I asked our Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry to take over leadership of our state-operated services, and she has made Security Hospital a particular focus and goes down there once a week to, you know, so that we have kind of personal oversight of what's going on there and our need to really improve what's happening at Security Hospital. I've spent a lot of time there as well. We have brought in a new hospital administrator for Security Hospital, and Carol Olson, and a new medical director. I think we're moving in the right direction. We have a lot more to do, and I'll be the first person to recognize that. But with everything we do, we see the building itself is a barrier to improving the treatment of the patients that are committed to us. You know, changing the building isn't going to solve all the problems, but the building itself is part of the problem. You know, so much of the work I do as commissioner is continuing the good work that our agency does at, you know, at the legislature's direction, and so many good build on the work of our good employees. You know, but sometimes you actually, as commissioner, get to weigh in on things that I think matter. And I remember when our staff brought recommendations to me in the summer of 2011 about bonding recommendations. The number one recommendation, kind of building on the history, was we need more beds for our Minnesota sex offender treatment program. And it's not that we don't have to address the growth in that program one way or the other. But when I looked at, based on my visits, what our needs were, I said, look, we've got to make Security Hospital our number one priority. And I'll say a couple of the reasons why. But I took Governor Dayton down. The governor and I went and visited Security Hospital, and the governor was also deeply troubled by the conditions that he saw there and saw, recognized the need, which I think to renovate, which is why he included that in his proposal last year. So just very briefly, what we think this will do, the renovation will improve patient and staff safety. That is very important. We have too many assaults. We have too many patient-on-patient assaults, patient-on-staff assaults. You know, some of those things we can address through other measures, and we're trying to work very hard to do that. But if you go, for those of you who've toured the building, you know that there are really narrow hallways. There are very poor sight lines. And so particularly with this population, if you can't see who's coming around the corner, if you, as a nurse or security counselor, can't have a wide view of what's going on in a treatment area, but only can see part of it, you're much less likely to be able to stop or to intervene early and to prevent those assaults. So we need to improve patient and staff safety, and we are trying. Our proposal, we think, does a lot in that regard. We also, but it's not just about safety. We need to enhance the treatment environment. We think that if we can actually kind of have a hospital that separates those who need a lot of security, often those who are just admitted, from those who are more towards the end of treatment, that we will have a better treatment and we'll also reduce our lengths of stay. We think we can do that by this proposal as well. Another important thing is we need to separate the clients that we serve in the security hospital. These are vulnerable adults. These are mentally ill patients. And we need to separate them more completely from the sex offender population that's also on the campus. And now, so what our proposal tries to do is say, look, let's have the security hospital, our mentally ill and dangerous, serving the higher part, kind of the upper campus, and the sex offender program on the lower campus, so that we are not intermingling sex offender population with vulnerable adults. And we need to create more appropriate treatment space for our different populations so that those acute patients that need more security have it, but so that our patients that are in our pre-transition or our competency restoration, our transition programs, that we're really trying to move back into the community, you know, have appropriate space and they're not, is not the, and that's more appropriate for what their needs are. So with that, Madam Chair, I know that Mr. Johnson will have a lot more details, but once again, I just so appreciate you taking the giving me the opportunity to tell you why I think this is so important.
The other person who toured was Representative Mindy Greiling, who had a particular interest in mentally ill population, and came back and made me promise, she said, talked about the disgrace of that building for this population, and so it certainly got it on my radar screen as well. We're going to have the whole presentation, but if you have a question specifically for the commissioner, Representative Carlson.
If she was done, Madam Chair, I didn't.
We're going to have somebody present, but she's on her way now to a cabinet meeting, so she was just giving some initial comments,
well,
and then we have
mind,
somebody.
Maybe a quick question then of her, being that you emphasized that planning money was given last session and it was a governor's priority. Generally, when we give planning money, the intent is to move forward. So my question is, why the change, and what is the long-range plan? When do you plan on making the request?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson. I just, at this point, the governor will, you know, make a decision about bonding, and at that time, that's a different decision than, you know, and a different process.
And I can explain, members, we've asked some of these departments to come forward to talk about projects before the governor has made his recommendations. He has not yet made his recommendations or his bill. So neither the commissioner nor I know what will be in that bill, and I think that's what you're saying. Other departments have told us the same thing, that we're asking them to come forth and they can talk about history, but they don't yet know what the governor will recommend to us this year.
Yeah, Madam Chair, maybe I misunderstood then, because I thought your earlier testimony was that the governor was not going to include this, but the decision is yet to be made then. Okay, that's an adequate answer for now. Thank you.
Good. Well, thank you. We'll then invite whoever who's making the rest of your presentation. We have... is it Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Johnson.
And thank you for being here, and to both commissioners, we appreciate the introduction to both of these issues. And then, so we'll continue to go through the slides here, and then we'll go back to housing, because we haven't quite finished that one up. So thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And now we're joined by Chuck Johnson, who is the Chief Financial and Operating Officer for DHS. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Chuck Johnson. I serve as the Chief Financial and Operating Officer for the Department of Human Services. I'm pleased to be here to have the opportunity to share with you the work we've done on planning for the St. Peter campus. As the Commissioner said, really focusing today on talking about the work that we're doing in planning for renovation and improvement of the security hospital. The first slide that I put up on the screen explains, as the commissioner indicated, we have two different populations that we serve on the St. Peter campus, really through two separate programs. The population we're talking about today and talking about the security hospital is the first. These are the civilly committed folks who are committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous. These are folks who are served through the security hospital, which includes transition programs as well as the more acute security, secure beds as well. This is a population that are classified as vulnerable adults in law. These are folks who we have indicated are in need of protection because of the state of their illness. The second population that you see here are people who are civilly committed as sex offenders. It's a population that I think has certainly gotten a lot more attention and people tend to be more familiar with. These are folks who are committed to us, usually coming out of after a prison stay, as sexual psychopathic personalities or sexually dangerous persons. It's a much different population in the sense that they are not classified as vulnerable adults. They are, in fact, predatory. Right now, as the commissioner indicated, as you see as I go through the slide deck, we have these populations together in the St. Peter campus in a way that we think is not an appropriate or safe arrangement going forward.
And so just to be clear, members, today the project we're talking about fits in that first category. As you know, we're doing some policy work on that other issue, and I suspect that may inform us about projects later. But we mention them both because they both happen to be on the same campus and, in a sense, sort of drive some of the need for separating populations.
That's exactly right, Madam Chair. Really the need to separate those populations and to provide the appropriate treatment environment for each population separately. This next slide shows you the bonding money that was approved for planning and pre-design and design in 2012, and then shows, based on that planning, our current estimates of what a two-phase project would look like for the Security Hospital, $46.8 million in 2013 and $51.7 million in 2014. This is clearly a large request. This is a significant building project. It involves demolition, it involves renovation, it involves new construction. It all has to be staged very carefully because we are building around people who are currently in treatment and in various units and in beds. And so we are moving populations in order to renovate one part of the building, moving them back, then renovating another part, building new buildings to help move people into more appropriate treatment, all of which has to be staged. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later in the presentation. We have several objectives that we're trying to get to with this request for the Security Hospital related to the St. Peter campus. First, really, as the commissioner suggested, we have an outdated facility, and it really is affecting patient and staff safety. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go forward. But the poor sight lines, the narrow stairways, the halls, the inability for security staff and for patients to feel like they know what's around the corner when they're going down a stairway. It also responds to the need to separate patients coming in to really have the kind of facility where we have a place for patients that are in crisis, a place for patients that are in acute need of care, and those that are in transition, where they can all be in separate and appropriate kinds of place of treatment environments, which we don't really have right now with the setup that we have. Also, as we just talked about, separating the sex offender population from the mentally ill and dangerous population, separating the vulnerable adults from those who are committed to us for the predatory nature of their crimes. And then finally, really developing on the upper campus of the St. Peter a modern residential treatment facility that's appropriately secure and appropriate for the treatment we need for our population. Here you're going to want to look up at the screen because I don't think your black and white will serve you terribly well. I'm not sure how easy it is to see this either. This is an overview, a plane shot, I guess, of the campus in St. Peter. And just to orient you, along the bottom of the screen, you'll see running there is the Minnesota River. And just north of that is 169. It's an area of the state a lot of us are familiar with, driving down 169, very beautiful with the big river bluffs along there. The reason we talk about an upper and a lower campus is because that river bluff runs right through the campus. If you look kind of toward the middle part of the screen, there's a big blue building. That's the Security Hospital, kind of toward the top in the middle. That's on the upper part of the campus. Then you see a collection of multicolored buildings that are kind of below that to the right. That's down the bluff. And it doesn't look like there's a lot of space between them, but what that is the river bluff. So it really is a very distinct physical separation of the two pieces of the campus. And on the lower campus, you'll see we have buildings that are colored blue. Those are buildings that are currently serving folks in the Security Hospital population. We also have buildings that are coded in red, and those are the sex offender buildings, the buildings that currently house sex offenders. So you can see those populations are blended together on that lower campus. Our goal is really to get all the Security Hospital patients and services and different treatments environments to that upper campus and have the lower campus then be available for the sex offender program and create that physical separation. There are also some shared buildings that are coded here in that kind of tannish color. Those will continue to be some shared buildings. We can get efficiencies by having... If you look up at the screen, I'm sorry, I know you don't have the color. It's kind of hard to see. We'll have some buildings or some functions that will continue to be shared between the two programs to create efficiencies in running the campus as a whole. The next few slides show you a little bit about what the environment looks like now and what it could look like. This graphic is a picture of inside the Security Hospital in one of the patient living areas. And what you can see is we have these odd split-level units that have been built with very narrow stairways and narrow halls, and an inability for, this is kind of how this would look if you were sitting in the nurse's station. You'd be looking at these hallways and these stairways and not able to see what's around the corner, not able to see down these narrow stairways very well. This not only affects the security, but really affects the patients. The patients themselves not feeling secure because they don't know what's around the corner either. Also, stairways aren't a great idea for a population that's often heavily medicated. It can be very difficult for them to navigate stairways. That's another area where it doesn't make a lot of sense to have these kind of split-level environment that we have. You can also see that it's kind of dark. If you look through to the window, you can get a pretty nice view of how what a nice setting this hospital is in through the windows. But the facility itself is very institutional and not set up well for a secure treatment environment. This slide shows the Anoka Regional Treatment Center. This is also a facility that's run by the Department of Human Services that also serves a mentally ill population in a secure environment. This is what a modern treatment environment can or should look like. You can see the nurse's station here that has good vision in all directions, able to see what's coming up and down the hall, able to see all the environment around them. You can see wide corridors, well-lit, good sight lines up and down for both the patients and the staff. This next one was a picture taken by our staff who visited a facility in South Dakota that Avera runs, again, a secure treatment facility. Here, the nurse's statement is kind of in the station is kind of in the foreground to the left here. And you can see, again, a very open environment, ability for the nurses to be able to monitor what's going on, both in the day area, in the interaction, a place where patients interact with each other, as well as being able to see the rooms and the doors of the different patient living areas. And again, this kind of more open and warmer environment is not only better from a safety standpoint, but also a better treatment environment for folks who are working to recover from their mental illness. I'll dive a little bit more into the detail of what this plan would propose to do in terms of the renovation and new building within this security hospital. Really, the phase one is really focused, and this would be the 2013 request if we were moving forward, to better serve the most acute population. That's really directed at starting with some new building within the security hospital to create better environments. So you can see here there are several bullets of what we do in phase one. Secure a 4-bed evaluation and 12-bed crisis unit. The crisis unit is a higher security unit. We don't have that right now. It's kind of a gap in what we have when patients go into crisis. They're often getting served in the same unit that they're currently in, which disturbs other patients. If you can get the crisis patients into a place where you can manage their crisis separate from the other patients who are recovering, who are still in recovery, you can be in a better position to not have creating problems for other patients when crises do occur. Also, the 4-bed evaluation unit, so that when patients first come in, we have a chance to put them in a unit apart, again, from the other patients, be able to observe and assess what their issues are and where the most appropriate place to place them is. And that's a real key part, again, that we don't have within the current system and is really important in any modern treatment environment. We'd also build 40 beds of new acute patient housing and 24 beds of transition unit, as well as building a social center, vocational building, a central plant, and a new administration building. This is part of really getting some of the functions that are shared on the lower campus now built and up on the upper campus so that we can separate the populations and have that more appropriate treatment environment. The administration building is actually a relatively small piece of this, but one of the things we don't have right now is space for our administrators within the security hospital. They're actually on the lower campus. And that isn't some administration, training, IT, HR, that can stay on the lower campus and be shared with MSLP. But for the people that are involved directly in patient care, the director, the clinical director, the program directors, they really need to be in the facility working with the folks in the facility, and we need to have that space appropriate for them as well. Phase one also includes the planning money for phase two, so that's included in that $46.8 million. This graphic, again, you either can't see it from where you're sitting or it doesn't look very good in your slide, but this gives you a sense of what the plan would look like for the first phase, or for both phases of construction, actually. The blue areas are new construction, and the sort of, I guess, orangish areas are the phase two new construction. And then what you see in the yellow and green, that's really the footprint of the current building, most of which is going to be renovated mostly in phase two to get rid of those split levels that we looked at and make that a single level and to create more appropriate space within the building for the acute care setting as well as for some of the more shared space. I'm not going to run through all the detail on this, but you can see if you look down the text that's next to the graphic, each of the pieces and where they'd be located under our current plan for the Phase 1 and Phase 2 building and renovation. In Phase 2, we really focused then on a lot of the renovation of the existing building, as I just mentioned, remodeling living units within the building for more pre-transition beds and acute beds, reconstructing those split-level units to make it a single-level unit, more open, better lighting, as we saw in the examples from Anoka and from the South Dakota facility. A 16-bed unit particularly dedicated to the female patients. I think our female patients are around 20% of the total population at the Security Hospital. We need to have appropriate care and treatment for them as well. And about 72 new beds of transition housing, as well as some additional vocational space in Phase 2. All this also includes doing a lot of renovation within the Security Hospital building. We don't have, for example, a sprinkler system within the building now. It's an old building that has a lot of work that needs to be done to just to bring it up to code, to create better efficiency in how the building operates for heating and ventilation and so forth. This graphic gives you a sense of, this is a schematic of the lower campus, and the buildings that are circled here in red, if you look up at the screen, those are the two buildings that right now house transition patients for the Security Hospital, Bartlett Hall and Johnson Hall. You can see in between those two buildings are blue-coated buildings. Those are the buildings that currently house the sex offender program, Paxton and Shantz and Green Acres. And there is a secure, that pink line there, if you can see it from where you are, is secure razor wire around security, the sex offender program. But both some of the sex offenders that are on the lower campus, as well as some of the Security Hospital patients on the lower campus, have campus rights, meaning they can be out walking around on the campus. And again, we have those two populations potentially mixing as they're taking advantage of their rights to move around the campus in a way that we don't think is a good long-term mode for having a safe and secure environment for both populations. So this really gets at why we believe we need to separate the populations and move the Security Hospital folks up to the upper campus in their entirety. I have three slides here that get into sort of how we're staging this in terms of moving around the beds for the different parts of phases of treatment. And I'm not going to go through this in great detail. This is not a proposal that's about building new beds in the Security Hospital. It's really about building the right kind of appropriate treatment environment that is going to enhance the security and safety of both our patients and our staff. We do, as we go through the phases, lose some beds and get them back. We end up with about the same number of beds as this 352 when we get to the end of the project. It's just that we get there by making a lot of different moves. So you can see here on the first slide that we have in the existing MSH building 159 acute beds. Then Bartlett and Johnson have the transition and pre-transition beds, which are for the folks who are getting toward the end stages of their treatment. CRP is the Competency Restoration Program. These are folks who are sent to us for treatment to make them competent to stand trial. Folks, when the court determines that they're not competent to stand trial, they're sent here and go through a program to try to bring them to a point where they'd be competent to stand trial for whatever crime they've committed. Again, that's within the existing MSH building now. And we have assisted living beds that are within Bartlett Hall right now. This shows you what would happen in Phase 1. And you can see we actually end up with a few fewer beds after Phase 1. When you get to in Phase 2 on the next slide, you just move back up to about 356, so a little four more than we started with. But what we're doing here is a lot of vacating beds out of one place, moving them to another place, potentially vacating them in one place and building new beds and moving them. And you can, if you follow through the slide, you can see the logic of each of the moves that we're making here. The first phase really does focus in part on moving folks out of Bartlett Hall, which is on the lower campus, which currently houses transition and pre-transition patients. That is to make that facility available for the sex offender population to be renovated and create additional beds for that population. So that's how we're sort of linking these two proposals that are here. We're also moving the assisted living beds to the forensic nursing home. Makes more sense to have them there. We don't need to have as many as 20 beds. We think 12 is adequate. So this plan also addresses that in a relatively straightforward way. And again, members, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on sort of the movement here, but you can see, as I said, we end up with a number of beds that's very similar to where we started, but just more appropriate in terms of where those beds are placed, the kind of treatment environments we've created, and also the creation of the crisis beds and the evaluation unit, which aren't separately listed here, but are really important to having the right kind of treatment environment for our populations. This slide gives you a summary of the security hospital and what we believe we'd achieve out of the first doing the two-phase project. And again, this lists the number of different beds that we'd be able to get and the advantages of that. But I think the first three bullets really hit on what are themes that are really important to us in this project: improving safety for the security hospital patients and their staff, enhancing the treatment environment. And we also believe this can help reduce the average length of stay. The average length of stay right now in the security hospital is about 8 years. Unlike the sex offender program, we do have a lot of folks coming out every year. We are able to move people through and get them placed into the community. But 8 years is longer than what we see in the national average for this type of program. And we think that is in part because we don't have the right kind of treatment environment to move people through those sort of phases and stages of treatment, getting them to the transition point and then making that community placement available to them. And actually, elsewhere in the governor's budget, we have a couple of initiatives that are aimed at really helping on the community side of that, creating those community placements for the populations so that we can have the appropriate place to move folks into in the community. And then also the physical separation of the vulnerable adults from the sex offenders. And then you can see listed here a summary of what we get in terms of the outcomes for new beds and reconfigured beds that really create a more appropriate environment for the treatment of this population. Really, when we brought forward the proposal in 2012, as Commissioner Jessen said, we were focused on a new strategic vision of how we wanted to reconfigure the St. Peter campus. A vision that would both allow us to create the right environment for treatment for the security hospital patient, deal with what is really an outmoded and old building that is no longer appropriate and in some ways is very inappropriate for the population that we're serving, creates danger and issue both for patients and staff, but also to separate those populations so that we create space for the sex offender population on the lower campus. We did get the design, pre-design money. We completed the pre-design in January. You're seeing in front of you the result of that in the process of executing a design contract with those dollars that provided in 2012 as well. Really, if we're able to move forward in 2013 with the request that's presented here, that would allow us to begin to address the acute populations, getting those beds built first and improving our services for treatment for the acute population, as well as beginning to move the process of vacating the lower campus and making that available for the sex offender program. If we're able to move forward with both phases of this project, we believe it would be substantially complete by about January of 2016. So it will be a long project, but we believe that it is the right thing to do for the populations we're serving in St. Peter. You see the very last slide also gives you a sort of timeline on how that would play out if both phases were funded timely with the way this plan has been laid out. I'm not going to go through that in detail, but it gives you a sense of the work that we'd have to do to sort of stage this project out. With that, Madam Chair, just thank the committee for the opportunity to be here and share this information with you.
Massive project. I don't see any questions, though. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick one. You mentioned the average length of stay for folks who are in the other various parts of the hospital, but I didn't hear you say for the sex offender. Have we released, was it one person from the sex offender program? I'm trying to remember what that is and what is the average length of stay.
Mr. John.
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, we provisionally released one person last year. I'm not sure what the average length of stay is. I could get that information for you, but I think the point is made that We do move people through the security hospital. We are able to successfully treat people and move them to the community. That is still much a work in progress with the sex offender population to get to a point where, and again, this goes to the issues that are being examined by the task force and others, how we both do a better job of treatment but also create potentially appropriate community placements for those that can be placed in the community.
And again, Representative Clark, just to be clear, none of this project that we're talking about here has anything to do with the sex offender program. This is only the security hospital that we're talking about here.
Well, Madam Chair, I think part of the urgency of this is to separate those two populations.
Correct.
And I think it's an excellent idea, and you've made a very good case for it. I would just like to leave you with a question, whether or not you can answer it or not. When we talk about transition and transition out, I would like to see a map of the transition out of all of the various folks in here, because I think it is a community issue in both regards, and some of us really care about that and want to make sure that there's good transitions and so on. But I think it would be good for us to know, because we do know that there's concentrations that happen outside of that hospital afterwards, and we should just be aware of it, and people need to think about that as part of the issue too. So I totally support your proposal. I just want to have a little more information about the transition part.
And Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, what is the number of beds for the MSOP population at the facility currently?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Dean, I believe it's about 160 beds that are in St. Peter right now with the sex offender population. And I can get that for you if that's not correct, but that's my memory.
Okay. So it's about 350 beds in the non-MSLP portion and about 150 roughly. Thank you. And currently, do we have like a long-term plan for the MSOP beds at that facility? Is it to go down to zero? And then also, how do we determine who goes to Moose Lake and who goes here from MSOP?
Mr. John.
Madam Chair and Representative Dean, to the latter part of your question, the St. Peter campus for the sex offender program is actually the latter stages of treatment. That's stages 3 and 4. So when folks are first come into the sex offender program, they go to Moose Lake. If they make progress in treatment, they will transition then to St. Peter, which is the environment where we treat the folks who are at the making more progress in treatment. To the first part of your question, I think that's the work in progress. The struggle that we have right now between the work that wants to move forward with looking at the policy around who we're committing to the sex offender program, how the treatment works, and whether or not there are alternatives for how those folks could be housed or treated to this institutional model, that's still an ongoing conversation. What we have is sort of the current law reality, which is we are expecting 120 more sex offenders to be committed to us in the next biennium, and we need to have beds for those folks because that is what is the current law says we have to do if they're committed to us. And so we're sort of at that point of balance between is the future going to be different, or are we going to continue to have 50, 60 new folks coming to us every year that create not only a bonding pressure for beds, but also, of course, the operational costs of serving them.
And that's sort of up to the legislature right now. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And we're working with the legislature. We are very engaged in this as well.
Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just finally, it looks like if you add the pre-planning money, phase one and phase two, it's about $102 million. If you divide that up by 350, it's about $300,000 per bed. Is that roughly kind of what the budget is, and is that what we've seen in other states with facilities like this for renovation, and is that kind of where the costs are right now, or does that seem a little high?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I believe that math is right. I'd have to get you a comparison with other states. I think part of what adds the cost here is just the complexity of the project with doing a renovation and new building and demolition, and the staging of having to move the populations around as we're doing the work makes it probably somewhat more expensive than it would be just if we could go off to a new field, build a brand new building with 350 beds, and just move everyone there.
Thank you.
Do we have any?
I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Who is it?
Just
Representative Ward.
On housing, not on this.
We're going to invite the housing people back now.
Okay.
Is that what you had
yes,
in the
yes,
okay. Thank you. And now we're going to revert to housing, and Representative Albright gets the first question, if you can remember what it was. We interrupted the housing flow. We're joined now by Tanya Orr, who's the Assistant Commissioner. And Representative Albright, do you remember what your question was as we broke?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. As part of the presentation, and I'll refer to slide number 12, with regard to housing infrastructure and bond selection highlights, I was struck by the note that there's roughly about $10.2 million that this Rochester Square Apartments has received for rehabilitation and preservation. If we're amortizing that over 104 units, that roughly equates to about, and if the math serves me correctly, about $98,000 per unit.
Ms. Orr, is that question clear to you?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Albert. I think your math is correct. It is about $100,000 a unit. This is actually a property that's two three-story walk-ups, and it's a mix of units. It was built in 1979, so it has a number of systems that need to be replaced and upgraded. There will be a number of things done, including work to the building envelope, the security common areas, and the actual units. So it's a significant project. It is also, as the slide notes, it is a Section 8 property, which means that the federal government makes up the difference between what it costs to operate this building and what the tenants can afford to pay. So it is among the most affordable housing that is available in the state. So we will, by securing this property, preserving this property as a stable housing, we will preserve the flow of federal money into the state to keep this housing affordable.
Representative Albright.
So if by your just recent comments, we are being forced to renovate this at this level to continue the manna from heaven from Washington?
Madam Chair, Representative, we're not being forced to. The agency has a priority to preserve this federally assisted housing because it is some of the most affordable housing. We could not replace this housing at the same cost. It is much less expensive to do rehabilitation than it is to do new construction. So that's the decision that we made, was to invest in this property again so that the federal assistance would continue and we would preserve these 104 units.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as a cost-benefit comparison then, what would new construction cost?
Ms. Orr?
Madam Chair, Representative, the new construction cost depend upon the size of the units and the type of building. I would be happy to get you the range. It can be between $150,000 for an efficiency apartment to over $200,000 for a family unit.
Representative Albright.
And I'm just wondering, is that cost indicative of the location, or is it indicative of the requirements obligated of the units?
Ms. Orr.
Madam Chair, Representative, the cost reflects both the market in which the property is located. The agency itself does not impose significant design requirements beyond the building code. So it's not a requirements of the funding. It is a reality of what it costs to develop good, safe, durable, affordable housing.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so in light of that, in the competitive bid process, my assumption would be that there would be a variability in terms of the bids from low to high. Are these numbers based upon engineer and architectural renderings and assumptions, or competitive bid process?
Ms. Orr.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that, keep in mind, this is a privately owned property that is bringing money to the table and asking the state for assistance. My understanding is that these properties all have competitive bids before financing is provided by the agency.
Is that proper?
And you mentioned that it is a private entity. Do we know the name of that private entity?
Is it?
Madam Chair, Representative, the developer's name is Joseph Development LLC. I believe that it is a Weiss property in Rochester.
Any further?
No, I'm sufficiently.
Representative Ward. And then, members, we have three agencies, Lutheran Social Service, Portico Collaborative, and Ebenezer, who are going to speak to us briefly about their experience with the opportunity to participate with MHFA. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Orr, as I listened intensely to the presentation, I salute the strategic priorities on slide 4 that the agency has, and there's many areas in the state that need those priorities badly, and I come from one of those areas. So I'm gonna reference your map on page 10 as well. And Commissioner Orr, I recently attended a Lutheran Social Services youth homelessness forum in my district, and I think they went around the state actually and had a number of those forums. And I repeatedly hear from folks in my district and around the state about the significant problem with youth homelessness and veterans homelessness in the areas of the state. So as I look at the map of 2012 selections, just a couple quick questions. And if I'm correct on this, there were 39 total projects awarded in 2012 around the state of Minnesota. You know, where the projects were awarded is significant, obviously, you know, all over the state. But in the Northeast and West Central and Southwest and Central, in those areas there seems to be lacking. Now, my question is, so have they received, in previous years, have they received, you know, is there a map, is there a way to tell the total kind of programs that we have appropriated money for homelessness in the state of Minnesota ongoing so that we can look at, you know, what we have in the state of Minnesota?
We love maps that give us some sense of the...
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, we actually provide a program assessment every year that shows the regional distribution of funding that the agency provides each year. And we can provide... I'd be happy to get you a copy of that. We can also map that information. This is a snapshot of 1 year's worth of selections. And it doesn't reflect... this is only the capital. So the other thing that the agency does is provide rental assistance and homelessness prevention assistance, which is provided statewide. So this is a portion of what we do, but not everything. And I'd be happy to get you the additional information.
Madam Chair, Representative Warren. Thank you. And that'd be great, please. You know, in the community of Brainerd, one of the communities that I represent, there's more rental properties, far more rental properties, 50-some percent versus home ownership in my community, in that community. So when you go to award projects, do you prioritize your list, and what kind of criteria do you look at?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, we do prioritize. We look at a number of different criteria. We look at some basic information such as the developer's capacity and the market in which the project is suggested. So is it feasible given the market? But we look at policy priorities such as does this project serve the population in the area? So does it match the rents that are going to be charged, match the incomes of the people that live there? Does the project, is it located so that there is good access to transportation, jobs, and services? We encourage economic integration. So we look at projects that are that provide affordable housing in areas where there maybe isn't very much, or that are economically integrated themselves, so have a mix of incomes in them. We look at leverage. So projects that bring other funding sources to the table are prioritized. So those are the main priorities that. So it's not simply a financial. Does the project work? It also is a question of does this make sense in terms of investing state dollars?
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Orr. I'm kind of going off of what Representative Albright was talking about. You know, I'm looking at slide number 12, and based the $100,000 per unit remodel cost, and I'm trying to make sure that I understand this correctly. It was $4 million in state bonding and the $6 million in private financing, so it's a 60-40 split?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair. So is that typical of the type split that you do, or does it vary greatly by project? I mean, if it's a 50-50 split or a 35-65, that's fine, but I'm...
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, as Commissioner Tingerthal mentioned, one of the tools that we use most frequently for the development or rehabilitation of rental housing is the Federal Housing Tax Credit Program. And that typically provides between 50 and 60% of the equity in a project. That's representative of this project where there's a 40-60 split. It does in part depend upon the type of project. When we're providing funding for supportive housing, like the example in the slide ahead of the Rochester Square slide, where the tenant contribution for the rent is very low and the project can't support any debt, really, then it's a much larger contribution from the state.
Representative Mahoney.
So just to follow up, only because you mentioned it, and it's always bad when you give way more information and create more.
Be careful, Ms. Orr.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's talked to me many times and walked out of my office shaking her head, so it's not the first time. Of the $6.2 million in other financing, mm-hmm. is that the federal tax credit dollars? So is the private contribution basically a federal tax credit?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, okay, so now you've asked for the details.
Very briefly, because we have testifiers.
$2.4 million of it is the federal tax credit syndication proceeds. So remember, the tax credits are sold, and that brings the equity in.
Yep.
There is a mortgage that the owner is going to have, which is $2.7 million. And then there are various other funding sources.
Thank you.
Representative Clark?
I want to hear from the witnesses, so I'm going to just be very brief and just say one thing, which is maybe this could come to the committee in a memo or something, just the relationship of the need to the actual amount that was appropriate last time for the repair. And I guess the other thing would be, I mean, separate from the issue of how much something costs to repair, what would it cost to replace this housing if we did not... if we did not repair it? And that's one of the, I think that's a kind of a very important consideration. And my understanding in the past is it's a really good investment to repair it rather than wait and try to let it deteriorate and then try to have to replace it. So I just wondering if you could
we'll
provide that in.
Through. It sounds like that would be good information to have. So we'll follow through with Ms. Orr about that. And then Representative Albright, and then we'll go to our testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up on a thought pattern. Once we let the development receive the funding from the state or whatever have you, what follow-up do we require of the receiver as to where that money is expended and that it is being appropriated to the project intended for that funding?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we have a significant system in place. We have three architects on staff who approve any draws for any finance, any funding that that a development receives. They do regular site visits. So the money, we are certain that the money is spent on the development in the way that it was proposed. And as the commissioner mentioned, you don't get money from the Housing Finance Agency without promising and us monitoring to ensure that you have provided affordable housing for a long term.
And I guess just the final question, do projects ever come in under budget?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, in fact, they do. You had a cancellation, a small cancellation in the last couple of years of a project in Hennepin County that came under budget.
And then we automatically cancel those. We're going to ask, we have two people from Lutheran Social Service here, Patrick Connolly and Kirsten Anderson. If they would come forward, we'll just hear from three of the agencies that are We've spent a good bit of time about this, and three of the agencies who are on the partnership end of this. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm with Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, my name is Pat Connolly. I'm the Housing Development Director at LSS.
Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota is in our 148th year providing services for the people of Minnesota. 75% of what we do is in greater Minnesota, so we appreciate your comments, Representative Ward. And we are pleased to be here today to talk in brief about one of our great aspirations, which is a commitment to assure stable and safe housing for all of Minnesota's children and young people. And one of the ways in which we're manifesting that commitment is to invest in housing development. And I'm pleased to be here with our expert of housing development, Pat Connolly, and hoping to give the committee through the page a drawing of a project we hope to be able to complete if indeed housing infrastructure bonds are able to be appropriated in the near term. I'll close by saying that we also are in great support of the Homes for All effort, an effort that brings together 40 organizations who support the development of housing throughout the state.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you,
Mr.
Madam Chair. I'll let the drawing be distributed.
Okay.
The building that you can see or will see, we're going to call the Center for Changing Lives. It'll be in Duluth in partnership with First Lutheran Church. So they're approximately 12 blocks east of downtown near the Rose Garden. And before I go any further, if somebody asks me what time it is, I start to explain how to build a watch. So I'll try to keep it simple, and then you can ask me what you want to know. Last year, the programs that will be housed in this building will be roughly tripled in terms of the number of kids that we can help find a safe place to live. Last year, we had to turn away about 150 kids because we don't have the capacity right now. And the partnership with the church, they'll be providing the land to us for free, well, for $1 a year. And that will help just further cement the financial and volunteer relationship that we already have with them. With that, I'll be happy to take questions about details.
You know, to the discussion that Representative Albright and Representative Mahoney were having, at one point I asked, and I can't remember if it was Ms. Orr or somebody, could we write into the law that somehow we give preference to sort of that practical per square foot project? And then they pointed out the problem here. You see Lake Superior in the background, that if you build in Duluth on rock, it's unfortunately going to cost a little more than it might somewhere else where the building environment was different. So it was helpful to remember that there are challenges some places that there are not in others. So questions. This is what they're bringing us is that they're one of the agencies that's in partnership. Your first Center for Changing Lives was in Minneapolis, and now you're proposing this one in Duluth as the one that you would be perhaps bringing forward this time around. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You pointed out that last year you turned away 150 kids. Where did those kids go?
Mr. Connolly or Ms. Anderson, I don't know.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, we do our very best through our street outreach, which is outside of the purview of this committee, but to help young people find safer places to be. Unfortunately, there's just a lack statewide of shelter and safe places to be. So we strategize with young people. Is there a couch they can sleep on? Is there a place that they may be yet welcome? But there are not always good solutions for that.
Madam Chair, I just know in my own city, because of the lack of shelter and protective housing for homeless youth, public policy at the time was to when kids were able to be in a shelter during the day or a facility during the day, the policy was to give them a bus ticket to ride the bus all night. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if that's something Duluth has had to do or
anything Ms. like that. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, that's one of the very last solutions, but it is one that is available. We also just collected some data about where young people are sleeping throughout the state of Minnesota. We provide services in Mankato, Brainerd, Wilmer, Bodchester, and Duluth and the surrounding region, as well as the metro. And we have a whole list of where young people have been finding places to sleep, and that includes stairwells, bridges, squatting in motels that have been since closed, foreclosed dwellings, which has, of course, inspired us to continue to press as much as we can to provide funding and real appropriate housing solutions for young people.
I see no further questions, so thank you for your partnership in this effort and for giving us a sense of your next the next challenge you'll be looking at. And now we have the Portico Collaborative. And we could be joined also by the Ebenezer Project. Since we've got two chairs there, we'll just have the last two testifiers come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lee Blons. I'm the Executive Director of Portico Interfaith Housing Collaborative. I'm here to...
And that, I believe, is Wilder and then several... are they Presbyterian churches or specifically? Or?
Yes, as an organization, we're a collaborative of over 50 congregations, and we have created and renovated 15 apartment buildings in the community. What we're working on now is Prior Crossing, which would provide that safe and supportive housing for young people that was just referred to. We have acquired land on the Central Corridor along University Avenue. To be able to create Prior Crossing. You do have a drawing that's been handed out to you. Wilder Foundation, one of the superior social service agencies in St. Paul, will be our service partner. We will develop this with your assistance. This is the type of development that could be created with housing infrastructure bonds if you were to appropriate those funds.
And this is what, and she's talking now about the one, this one was on your, could have been on that table.
And just for you to understand, I realize that before you are many needs that the state has in terms of how you invest capital dollars in our community. And I'm here to really bring to your attention the 13,000 people, whether they're young people, children, families, or adults often with mental health or chemical dependency issues that do not have stable housing on any given night, both here in the Twin Cities and throughout the state. We have, together as a community, realized that supportive housing, and that's the housing itself that needs to be very, very affordable for very, very low-income people, combined with supportive services right in the same building, does in fact end homelessness. So I really want you to know that we know how to end homelessness in our community. We need the resources and the community support to make that happen. I'm proud to say that we operate Nicollet Square, which is similar to Prior Crossing in Minneapolis. Opened just over 2 years ago with the investment of Minnesota Housing through the low-income housing tax credit and other funding that was available at the time. We now house 42 young people. They have 95% of our young people are employed. Half of them came in at 18 and 19 without a high school diploma, and almost all of them have completed that since coming in, and many of them are working on post-secondary vocational training as well. So this is an opportunity to invest in our community. The capital investment, which I know is in front of you today, is an investment in the young people and in that stable housing, but it's also an investment in the neighborhood. I'm very proud to say that with Nicollet Square, which was developed in the Kingfield neighborhood, we tore down a vacant funeral home that had sat vacant for a number of years and built Nicollet Square and created retail on the first floor. It was in the newspaper just this past week where Butter Bakery is now providing an amenity to the neighborhood and also jobs for our young people. The Neighborhood Association just held a fundraiser for us. And for you to know, as a nonprofit developer, as you know, affordable housing can have lots of stereotypes, and not everyone wants it built next to them. And I am so pleased to say that just 2 weeks ago, Kingfield Neighborhood, where we're located with Nicholas Square, held a fundraiser for our housing for homeless young people, and 400 people showed up to help provide the funding to keep the services going. And so we really can be not only a benefit to the young people who have that safe place to live in a future, but a benefit to the community and neighborhood as well. Just real quickly, let me show you the other side as well. This is a proposal for family housing. I'm sorry, Representative Dean had to leave. This would be in his district. This would provide housing for homeless families with the supportive services to help them move forward in combination with affordable housing for working families in the community, so that we create that kind of mixed income housing in which families that have struggled more are creating a community with families that need a little bit of help in terms of their rent, but are contributing members of our community, and to create that kind of supportive housing that it would be a benefit to both the families that would live there as well as the neighborhood. This would be in North Minneapolis, which, as you know, lost hundreds of homes to the tornado, and is an opportunity to reinvest there in the community as well.
Madam Chair.
And then finally, Representative, Mr. Lundberg, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you're talking about Emerson North, where exactly is that on Emerson North? Nowhere near the tornado area.
It's at Emerson and 18th. Madam Chair, Representative. It is located at Emerson and 18th. So it's within probably a quarter mile of where the tornado area went. It was not directly hit by the tornado.
Right. Thank you.
Representative Simmons?
Thanks, Madam Chair. When we look at some of these things, especially when they involve organizations or entities that have participated in something before or have a program, do we use anything that looks at their success rates or, you know, other metrics that we can verify, you know, that help us prioritize which ones are the most successful?
And that would be directed to Ms. Orr, Tanya Orr, I think.
Sure. Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Housing Finance Agency, as I mentioned earlier, does look at a number of, use a number of criteria in deciding what projects would receive funding. And one of them is the capacity of the developer. So we definitely look at past experience to determine whether we think that the developer can handle an additional project. We have the agency and the legislature in the past has supported this position of you all appropriate money to us, and then we sift through the applications and use our 40 years of experience with our architects and finance people to determine which projects are most suitable to go forward with state financing.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I might offer my perspective, when we create the capital investment, which Minnesota Housing has the primary role, we do provide to them also our plan for our service partner and the outcomes. So when it's supportive housing and it's in addition to the capital, we are held accountable for that success. We also then would work with our the direct funding of the supportive services. We're an organization that's been very successful at raising both private and public dollars, so we're matching public dollars with private dollars, but we are accountable back to our public funders for those same kind of outcomes, whether it's the Department of Human Services or the county.
And then finally, Mr. Lundberg from Ebenezer, and you've got a handout from them as
yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be able to be here today. You do have a handout regarding the particular project that I'm speaking of today that will give you a little bit of background information, but let me share just a little bit more for you with you. My name is John Lundberg. I'm the Vice President of Operations with Ebenezer, a not-for-profit provider of senior housing options throughout the state of Minnesota, ranging from skilled nursing facilities to assisted living, but also including independent senior housing. And it is within that independent senior housing sector that I'm here to speak today regarding one of our facilities, the Ebenezer Tower Apartments. located in South Minneapolis on Portland Avenue, and you'll see a picture of that on the handout that you have there. The Ebenezer Tower Apartments was built in 1970 and is one of Ebenezer's three permanent housing facilities in our South Minneapolis campus, and has provided 192 units of safe, affordable, supportive housing for the extremely poor for over 40 years. In 1992, partial Section 8 rent subsidy was added for 91 of the 192 units, and this allows residents to pay 30% of their income for rent, and HUD then pays the remainder. Rents have been kept low in the remaining units of the building to best serve the needy population. Today, 30% of the tenants at the tower are at 30% area income, and over 150% of the residents have incomes of less than, 150 residents have incomes of less than $17,000 per year. 82 of those individuals have incomes at or less than $10,000 a year. The tower provides housing for approximately 50 long-term homeless persons. Since receiving the original mortgage through the HUD 202 program in 1970, the tower has received no other capital funding to date. Like other senior buildings across the country funded under the HUD program, the building is in need of significant repairs, and HUD itself has not had the funds to provide capital improvements for this type of property. Therefore, Ebenezer has, over the course of time, needed to loan the property something in excess of $600,000 to keep it operating safely. Now we must raise $15 million for renovations to preserve the long-term mission for the building. This would fund such components of renovation as replacement of the fire alarm system and bringing it up to current standards, replacing aging and inefficient building systems, and functionally obsolete units that are in urgent need of replacement. This is a cost-effective project, with the total cost of the project being just $78,000 per unit, which covers construction costs, substantial reserves now required by funders, and all associated soft costs. This makes the tower renovation costs among the lowest of projects competing for funding. Considerable work has been done on this position, on this project to date. To date, $2.1 million has been secured from the City of Minneapolis, and Ebenezer has applied for supplemental funding opportunities with Minnesota Housing for $3.9 million in a deferred loan preservation funding. We're also requesting low-income housing tax credits that would generate nearly $7.5 million toward the cost of this effort. County and federal home loan bank funds would be requested to achieve the balance of the $15 million. This, as you well know, is a complex process, needing to knit together funding from a variety of sources to ensure the preservation of this important Minneapolis housing project. It's a puzzle of trying to connect all the pieces and all the dots, and all are dependent on the others. As I've noted, Ebenezer Tower has provided for the very low-income senior in the Minneapolis area for over 40 years. I strongly urge the committee to consider Tower and other projects like it in need of preservation funding as you identify funding priorities for this session. There are few options for needy seniors we serve, and without preservation funding, there will be even fewer options for a population which is only expected to grow as the aging demographic explodes in coming years. It is our intention, with the support of good persons such as yourselves, that we propose the Ebenezer Tower Apartments to preserve its record and sustain its ability to continue providing housing for the long-term homeless and the very low income well into the next 40 years.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask, when that tornado thing touched my memory, and there was a lot of several hundred homes that were damaged, some of them maybe beyond repair. Was there any public money that would help? Would help those people get their homes hammered back together, and so they could go on, and so we wouldn't have to build more public housing.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, as you know, the federal government didn't provide the assistance at anywhere near the level that they have in the past for other disasters, but the agency had some money that it made available to North Minneapolis on the same terms and conditions that we've provided funding to other communities that have suffered natural disasters. It was definitely a challenge in North Minneapolis. There were a number of hurdles One of the things that the disaster recovery efforts requires is that people apply for federal assistance first, and that was a challenge for a number of families. But we did offer several million dollars in assistance and did help some families make repairs to their homes.
Thank you. I have another question. Are some of these buildings are teardowns rather than keep repairing them, like the tower here, apartments? I mean, I know it costs more to renovate, but you're not going to bring them back to where they should be, probably even with the money you're asking for.
Mr. Lundberg. And yep. The other question we have, we didn't know, do you have a total request that you will be making to MHFA?
The total request to MHFA is the $3.9
million. $3.9
million. Yep. Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, the project that we're proposing is a complete renovation of that property. It's not a teardown, and it would allow, again, for replacement of windows, other infrastructure, repair and replacement, overhaul of individual apartment units, et cetera. So it is a complete renovation, and it is a significant improvement of that particular property.
We have overstayed our welcome. Thank you so much for giving us a little bit of context. Representative Mahoney moves the minutes of February 12. Any changes, corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, those minutes are approved. Meeting is adjourned.